Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello, my name is Andrew Loud, and one of the questions I face in my line of work as a reporter comes from proceedings of criminal trials. What happens? How does a case get to court? What exactly does it mean when a file is sent to DPP, or to give it its full title, the Director of Public Prosecutions? What happens in the courtroom during a trial? And why do cases, quote unquote, go quiet in the media? Well, let me explain. It's important to know, first of all, that when a crime is committed, the scene of the crime is sealed off, Gardaí collect evidence, they conduct searches, they interview witnesses to the crime, they might ask the person who came across the crime or who made the 999 call for initial remarks before later calling them back to give a formal statement. They could also have arrested a suspect, brought them to the local Gardaí station. There, they would take their fingerprints, other DNA samples, conduct formal interviews with the suspect, while in the background, those fingerprints and those DNA samples are being analysed against evidence that was found at the scene. Gardaí will compile the evidence, the statements from witnesses and interviews with suspects, and that phrase we've heard in various newspaper articles, radio or TV reports, a file will be prepared for the DPP. But what exactly happens next?
Noelle Kenny is my name. I'm Deputy Head of Policy and Research in the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution. When the guards have completed their investigation, they submit a file to our office that goes straight to the Directing Division, which is a division of solicitors and in this office, who will look at an individual investigation file and decide whether charges should be preferred or not. And so the file arrives at the desk of a directing officer. It can include multiple statements from witnesses in relation to the case. It can include CCTV. It can include DNA evidence, forensics. And the process of analysis begins once the investigation file arrives on a directing officer's desk.
There are a lot of processes DPP's office go through when it comes to a file it receives. There is scope, though, for more conversation and collaboration with Gardaí as to what it needs in order to progress a case.
If a file arrives into our office and we don't feel that we have sufficient information to make a decision, we will certainly go back to the guards. We might request, for example, a medical report, or we might request that a witness be re-interviewed. And so that would often be the case, that we need to go back to the guards and speak to them and say, we don't have enough at the moment to make the decision, and can you submit further information? We would also have files coming into the office that might contain very technical, complex information, and there would be times when the directing officer might request the guard or team of guards to come in to do a presentation, for example, in relation to CCTV. Say that, you know, we'd have many cases where there might be hundreds of hours of CCTV, and the directing officer might ask the guards to come in and do a presentation in relation to that to assist them in making their decision. Obviously, all of our decisions remain independent and objective, but that's not to say that we're not considering the views of the guards or the investigators in a case as part of that decision-making process.
For many serious crimes that require an urgent decision to prosecute, that can be made swiftly, often on the day, as Noelle Kenny explains.
The office operates an on-call service for the guards to contact in urgent circumstances like what you've referenced there. If somebody is detained in relation to a very serious charge and the guards need to charge them without having the time to submit a paper file or electronic file, a directing officer is in a position then to give the guards a direction to charge in those urgent situations.
How a case is tried, whether it's by summary trial before the district court or by indictment before the circuit court or the high court, can also be recommended by the DPP. Here, Noelle Kenny explains how that process goes.
The main factor for consideration for a directing officer in those circumstances is whether it can be deemed to be a minor offence, whether the powers of the district court will be sufficient to deal with the seriousness of the offending. And, you know, there is a public interest issue at stake here as well, I suppose, in relation to the efficiency of justice. So if something is sent for trial in a lower court, it will be dealt with much more speedily. So that is a factor that a directing officer might have to take into account We don't always have the power to indicate that something should be dealt with in the district court. It depends on what kind of offence it is. Some offences have to go to a higher court. But in the instances where we do have that power internally in this office to make that call, there's a second tier to that decision-making process. So say, for example, a directing officer in here decides to indicate that a matter should be dealt with in the district court. That decision will then also take place in the district court. The judge will hear a summary of the evidence and they will decide whether they deem something to be a minor offence or not. And so it can often be the case that this office might decide, well, we think this is a minor enough offence to say in the district court. And a judge might say, well, no, I disagree, and they'll send it forward to us. So it's a two-tier decision-making process. If we indicate that something is to be dealt with on indictment, then that's the end of the decision-making process.
However, as Noelle outlines, not every case is prosecuted.
First part of the decision-making process for directing officers in here is to establish whether there is a prima facie case. And what we mean by that is whether there is sufficient evidence to prosecute a criminal offence. And when we're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, we're not just looking at the evidence on its face, I suppose. We're looking at whether the evidence is admissible. And that means whether the procedural requirements have been complied with. For example, if a search has taken place and evidence has come out of that search, whether the processes, the powers used by the Gardaí or the investigative agencies have been used correctly, and whether that evidence will be admissible at trial. So that's one aspect of the analysis of the evidence. We also have to look at whether the evidence is credible. And that's, again, not looking at statements from witnesses and just taking them at face value. We're analysing those statements against the other statements in the case. We're wondering whether there is objective, independent evidence in relation to what a witness might be saying. And we're also always thinking about whether there's a reasonable prospect of conviction. It's in the public interest that taxpayers' money is used effectively and efficiently, I suppose. And if there's no real prospect of conviction in a case, and that's to a criminal standard beyond a reasonable doubt, then it isn't in the public interest to prosecute those cases. So it's quite, I suppose, a complex decision-making process. But at a very basic level, yes, it is about the evidence and whether there's sufficient evidence to prosecute a criminal offence.
A decision to charge has been made. A book of evidence containing everything the prosecution has in relation to the case has been served to the accused. So, let's fast forward to the trial. From the point of view of the media, first and foremost, a question I've been asked is, why does reporting on a particular case, quote unquote, go quiet, usually these high profile ones? There is a reason why this happens. So before someone is charged, you will see wall to wall coverage of a serious crime that gathers a lot of public attention. However, once an accused has been charged in relation to the crime and has appeared before the district court, reporting in relation to the case then becomes very much restricted to what happens during court proceedings, and everything that was commonly known before this time, essentially that wall-to-wall coverage, goes onto the shelf. Fine Gael Senator and practicing defence barrister Barry Ward explains why.
You know, we have some very good reporting of what happens in our courts, but the reality is, thank God, we don't have in this jurisdiction trial by media. And all you have to do is look at news channels in America to see how different it is across the water, where people, they have what they call the perp walk. The person is arrested and paraded in front of the media in handcuffs and things like that. In our courts, you have a lot of protections to avoid the contamination of any potential jury pool or jury member, so that they shouldn't serve, for example, if they know anyone in the case or know anything about the case. And you will never, as a jury member, for example, see somebody sitting in court in handcuffs. They will never be wearing the orange jumpsuits that you see them in courtrooms in America. And there's a series of protections in place to ensure that when the trial starts, the jury pool is, and the jury members are, relatively uninformed about what the case is. And the first they should really know about that case is when the prosecution barrister stands up to open the case to them, or when the judges wearing them in, so they have broad ideas about who's accused and who's involved.
When it comes to trial proceedings, an accused is arraigned, a plea is given and a jury is selected. However, there are instances where an accused can plead guilty to a lesser charge to the one they're accused of. Think of someone accused of murder pleading guilty to manslaughter, for example. Sometimes the DPP can accept this, sometimes they don't. Noelle Kenny from the office of the DPP explains how this can come about and how decisions such as the above are made.
The defence raise an offer and they do that either verbally in write or in writing to this office, and that is brought to the attention of the directing officer in the case. And then as part of that decision-making process as to whether that offer can be accepted, the directing officer will be considering a number of factors. They will be considering whether the offer meets the seriousness of the evidence in the case. There may be other information that has come to light between the decision to charge and the time an offer is made. For example, this might be raised by the defence. There might be weaknesses in the prosecution case. There may be further information that has come to light that might affect the credibility of a witness. The victims' views are always taken into account by the directing officer in this case. You know, victims can sometimes have strong views on whether they actually want to go ahead with the stress and trauma of giving evidence at a criminal trial. The victim's view isn't necessarily the determinative view that this office will take, but it's one of the factors that the directing officer will consider when deciding whether or not to accept a plea to a lesser charge.
But now, a trial is going ahead. Opening statements are the first order of the trial. The prosecution outlines its case and what the jury can expect to hear in terms of evidence. The defence is not obliged to give an opening statement. Senator Barry Ward explains why.
It's very unusual for two reasons. The first is you don't know what evidence you're going to call as a defence barrister when the trial starts, because very often the evidence you call will depend on what the prosecution does.
And you don't actually have to say what evidence you're calling until the prosecution finishes its case.
Yeah. So you, to an extent, you maybe don't want to show your hand before the prosecution starts, and that because it might dictate what they do. You don't have to do it, so why would you do it? Now, the reason why you might do it is if you know that you, so for example, in the case of you're advancing what's called a positive defence, where you're not sitting back and saying prove your case, but you're saying actually this is what happened, and you want to advance a positive narrative to the jury, you know you're going to call somebody. I would think, and I don't think this is actually written down, but it certainly would be the convention, that if a defence barrister gives an opening statement, then he or she is also committing to calling evidence.
Mm.
Because very often in your opening statement, you're saying this is going to happen. It can't then not happen.
Yeah.
You're kind of binding yourself into that. And there will be a small number of cases where that might be appropriate. But for the most part, defence barristers will keep their powder dry.
So during trial proceedings, the prosecution will go through various pictures and maps of the area in question. These will be referred to on a number of occasions as witnesses are called. And just on witnesses, these can be anybody from eyewitnesses. They could be Gardaí, the arresting Gardaí, the Gardaí who took the 999 call, Gardaí who conducted the interviews, senior Gardaí in charge of the case as a whole. They could be expert witnesses giving the likes of DNA evidence. And when a witness is called by the prosecution, their evidence will be examined and they will then be cross-examined by the defence, which means they'll ask questions based on the evidence that has been put before the jury. The defence doesn't actually have to cross-examine the witness. In fact, the defence doesn't really have to do anything at all. They don't have to cross-examine, as I said. They don't have to call witnesses, nor does the accused have to give evidence themselves. And it is often the case that they don't. The onus is on the prosecution to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. More often than not, they will cross-examine a witness, and they don't actually have to decide if they will give evidence themselves, the defence that is, until the prosecution rests. If the defence goes into evidence, that too can be cross-examined by the prosecution. However, the defence will give a closing statement where it will put its argument to the jury as to why the prosecution has not proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Barry Ward tells us what that would entail.
The last lawyer the jury hears from, if you like, is the defence counsel. And there is a strong school of thought from an advocacy perspective that before you ever go into a trial, you should have your closing speech written. Because the closing speech is a map, a roadmap to where you want to go in the trial. So by the time you stand up, you need to have ticked all of the little twists and turns in your closing speech. You'll have adduced evidence to support each one of them. And very often, the you do that, but your closing speech is also about asking the jury to look beyond maybe what something is said. So very often a guard will give evidence, and Dublin in particular, in Dublin, juries will feel that Gardaí are telling the truth, or they will put stock in what they say. One of the things the law says is that Garda evidence is no stronger than the evidence of anybody else. That's the kind of thing you might be pointing out to the jury. In a modern context, another thing you might say on the defence side is, where are the forensics? Everybody's seen CSI, so there's an expectation very often by juries that there'll be lots of forensic evidence in the case, and very often there isn't, particularly in less significant crimes. They won't have brought in a forensics team to fingerprint and examine hairs and all the rest the way you see on television. And so sometimes the defence will use that to say to the jury, actually, you don't have the evidence you think you have. Or most cases, you'll have a situation where it is one person's word against another.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very frequent scenario. And then you can say to the jury, well, look, what evidence do you really have? You have one person saying this, you have another person saying the other. You don't actually have any evidence beyond them.
So once the prosecution and defence have given their closing arguments, the judge will then deliver his or her charge to the jury.
A lot of judges will say at the outset of the case to the jury, you are the judges of fact, I am the judge of the law. And any factual issue is entirely a matter for the jury. But the judge is like a referee in a match. He or she, and it's more often she in fact today than he, but they will give the jury guidance on what the law is. So, for example, they will usually sum up the facts, but they'll do so, and when they're doing so, they will say to the jury, whatever I say, you can accept or disregard what I'm saying. When they're giving the jury advice on the law, it's essentially binding on the jury. So they will say to the jury, the elements of this offence are X, Y, and Z. So you must find that X, Y, and Z are present beyond a reasonable doubt. And then in a lot of trials, you'll have a concept, maybe take, for example, assault, the concept of self-defense. Self-defense is what's called a full defense to assault. So if the jury finds that you were defending yourself, then the answer is to say not guilty. But what is self-defense? So, for example, if you attack me and I stab you 100 times, is that self-defense? Well, it may be self-defense, but it's not legitimate self-defense, and it's not a defense in law, because the response from me must be designed to repel the attack and must be proportionate and reasonable in all the circumstances. And then there are other tests that the jury must apply. So there's an element of law that comes into it there. And that's where the judge will guide the jury on what they should be thinking about in terms of coming to their decision.
And then a verdict is given by the jury after their deliberations. Most of the time they have to come to a consensus, so they have to decide unanimously whether someone is guilty or not guilty. But the judge can decide after a certain amount of time, if the jury asks, to deliver a majority verdict. One of the most difficult aspects of trial proceedings is, despite being held in public, there's only so much evidence which can be reported due to time or article constraints. The media give the public access to trials in this way, but in the age of social media, where articles can be interpreted and potentially lead to more public analysis of live trials, which, by the way, could be in contempt of court, is streaming our trials so the public can actually watch the proceedings at home? Is this the answer? Barry Ward does not think so.
There was a trial a number of years ago, by which I mean they looked at the notion of broadcasting court proceedings.
Mm.
It has generally been decided that it's not a good idea. My own view is that, in fact, we should be video recording all court proceedings
and making them available post-trial.
Exactly. Or even applying something like the 30-year rule. But the notion, like, there are serious issues being tried in our courts that have a huge impact on the laws we make, on the way society views the court system, on the way we function as a society. And the nuance of that, it cannot be recorded in a typed script, because everything in court is now recorded. There's a thing called the digital audio recording. So everything that anybody says in court now is recorded, and the court service retains a copy of that. If there's an appeal, for example, a transcript of what was said will be generated for the appeal, so everybody knows exactly what was said.
Or even if the jury are looking back for what was said in a particular point of evidence.
And having that certainty of what was said is very, very important. But writing down a sentence or a question, for example, doesn't give you any idea about the intonation that was used, whether there was sarcasm, the looks that were exchanged between the jury and the barrister, or the judge and the barrister, whatever. All of that is lost. And I think there is also a cultural value in recording those certain trials for posterity, even if they're never released to the public or not released in the lifetime of whoever it might be, I think there is a loss in not video recording those things. But I would not be in favour of a court TV style model that we have in the United States, which is ultimately going to result in that kind of trial by media, which is totally undesirable for everyone.
So with all that in mind, that about wraps up Let Me Explain for this week. You can listen back to previous episodes on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. This week's edition was presented and produced by me, Andrew Loud. John Keogh is the series editor with Lachlan Hart on sound. Thanks for listening.